Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 77, section 7, which is old single column, page 863. All right, so recall that little section that we did at the end in the preceding session, where they gave us some direct details about the secondary midwares. So we finally have the existence of the secondary midwares explained to us. We were already touching on the whole issue of how those midwares came into relationship with the already existing primary midwares, and hence, very directly relative to the primary midwares, with all of the issues of the rebellion. Because all of those primary midwares, who definitively split into two camps, those who sided with Caligastia and those that didn't, right? All those midwares are on the planet back when the secondary midwares come into existence. So those midwares, once Adamson is gone, those secondary midwares are having to deal very independently with this whole issue of how do I see myself? How do I align myself? Do I join in with the Melchizedek receivers and kind of come under their leadership? Or what do I do? And remember, what is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth paragraph there of section 6, where they mentioned the 33 secondary midwares there that tried to get them all to kind of stay together, and they weren't successful. So you just had a very small number that aligned themselves with the loyal primary midwares and hence with the Melchizedek receivers. And most of them, beyond those 33, are just off in the world for thousands of years doing what they think best. Doesn't necessarily mean they were all on an evil tear. They didn't go rogue in that sense necessarily. Some did. But they might have just been doing a little roll your own goodness. What they thought would be helpful in the world. And that has its precedent. Van and Amidon did that for 150,000 years, pretty much by themselves, just trying to do what they thought was best. And so between, you might say the bad ones and the not so bad ones, or whatever you want to call them, there was a lot of very interesting influence on humanity for a very long time. You have these beings that very easily can engage mortals, engage matter, do stuff that humans are going to be aware of. Introducing a literalness to the long-standing human belief in a ghost world, right? That when you died, you became this ghost, and that eventually evolved into what was called a spirit, but nonetheless an idea that there's all these beings sort of just beyond the veil of sight that are doing stuff on the planet, and all of religion was based upon trying to please the ghosts or the spirits, or all that stuff has this very definitive literalization for thousands of years because of the secondary midwares, just about doing stuff. And I'm sure a lot of times, when they thought it was suiting their ends, feeding very literally into the human beliefs about the spirits, right? And, tailoring their behavior to match human expectations. So, very much it would have fed into that, the enduring belief in the ghost cult. They already hinted, if you look right there at the end of section 6, when they said that they were still productive of much mischief up to the days of Christ Michael. So there they're hinting at, and we'll get a reinforcement of the mischief thing there. And it says, we start reading, and then remember that, and they'll come back to this, it literally wasn't until 2,000 years ago, it wasn't until Pentecost, that all the secondary midwares were sat down and said, all right, okay, this is decision day, right, or choice day even, right? Choose this day whom you will serve, right? And so they all made a final choice about whether or not they were going to stay on the planet, and behave themselves, come under some leadership structure, or be taken off. Because at Pentecost, all of the rebel angels and midwares were taken off the planet, and they'll be mentioning that here shortly again too.
Seeing as you brought it up,
yeah.
To me, maybe I'm just a freaking idiot, but if I were had been a rebel midware, and then after the life of Jesus on this world, or Michael, I had a choice. I mean, why would I choose to join the bad guys?
Again, you don't see yourself as a bad guy. You see Michael as the bad guy. You see yourself as a good guy.
Still doesn't sound logical to me, but anyway.
Yeah, obviously it's not valid. But remember, these are all brilliant beings. They have a logic. It's just a false logic. They're all playing off of Galagashia, who's leading that false logic. There is this whole worldview, this whole framework that Lucifer constructed and Galagashia adopted and taught to everyone here that joined him, this whole vast airtight belief system, that rationalizes everything and it flips reality around, right?
Which is true, but when you see even the life of Michael versus Jesus mm-hmm. the last 4 or 5 years, whatever, and the things that transpired and the communiques and so on and so forth, if they were able to observe that, I don't know, it would just...
I agree. It's very difficult for us to imagine how any of them would say, no, I'm with Galagashia. Another thing we have to all keep in mind is how impressed humans are by even the slightest out of the material norm fact.
True.
Beings from all over the universe of universes is just, whatever to them. I see them all the time, it's all, they're all just Bob, to them. And so it's hard for us to put ourselves in that position where we think of fancy spiritual beings in some whatever vanilla fashion. For humans, all you have to do is make a fancy blob of protoplasm called Adam and Eve, and we're all dropping down on our knees worshiping them like they were God. But for them, you know, our archangels, you know, are part of this vast conspiracy of oppression, you know, this Michael, sort of stuff, you know.
Michael's just a representative of the foreign potentates.
Right. Yeah. Right. Michael has drunk the Kool-Aid, you know, and I mean, that's the way they see it. You know, and they don't see, you know, even a creator being as something, you know, genuinely transcendent. You know, it's just, you know, another flavor of fancy, you know, like they all are. You know, anyone can, you know, turn this knob and make yourself visible or invisible. I mean, you know, all that physics is just trivial to them. For us, it's ooh, ah, right? And anything like that, you know, especially if it has anything to do with energy of any sort, immediately invokes the word awesome in our mind, you know, and we want to worship the Almighty.
Yeah, that's true. You know? But by this time, no. Both Lucifer and Satan had been in turn, which I would think Caligari.
No, not Satan. No. Remember, Satan's still.
Oh, Jesus saw him falling from the sky, remember? I mean, that's before.
No, I mean, that's, you know, remember, Satan wasn't interned until right at the beginning of the 20th century. You can go back and check on that. So, you know, remember they tell you.
He wasn't allowed in the council or something like that?
He was starting to be shut out of, right, yeah, of going up to Edentia and stuff like that, right? But he was still running around to the rebel worlds until the beginning of the 20th, you know, remember they say right at the time of the writing of the Revelation is when he was finally in. You know, and joined Lucifer in the prison world. So,
I mean, I know what happened. I'm not questioning.
Yeah, not to mention again, you know, the Midwayers. You know, you can, you know, Midwayers. You know, you think, well, aren't they kind of minion-like? And you know, and wouldn't the majestic Michael kind of? It's like, you know, wouldn't they just sort of? Okay, I'm cooperative subordination to you. But remember the Caligastia and Dalagastia and a whole bunch of other higher, you know, higher than angel rebels are on the planet.
So is Gabriel.
You know, and they're just as brilliant a spirit being as Gabriel is.
Right.
You know,
and so remember there's a whole bunch of angels that make decisions at the same time, right?
Yeah. Anyway,
the person who's in charge of the country doesn't necessarily have the respect of everybody in the country. Like, there's the rebel instinct, regardless. I was always struck by that, the foreign potentate idea.
Yeah, and we'll actually, you know, as we get into this here, right at the very beginning, these first two paragraphs, we'll see a couple of facts that they lay out that speak to this. So, I mean, I just want to pause it right there and let's read a little bit and we'll, you know, we'll see, we'll talk about this issue a little bit more about why is it that that they're so susceptible to this delusion? Right? Because that's what we're struggling with. It's like, how could you possibly fall for that? That, you know, you've got Michael standing there in Caligastia, and then you go, no, I think I'll pick Caligastia. I mean, how, right? I mean, it just seems impossible to us. Right? So what is the key to understanding that fundamentally?
Yeah, didn't they say that even Voldemort turned his head at the crucifixion?
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. So let's get into this whole rebel phenomenon here. And talk about it some more.
Number 7, the rebel midwares. The majority of the primary midwares went into sin at the time of the Lucifer rebellion. When the devastation of the planetary rebellion was reckoned up, among other losses, it was discovered that of the original 50,000, 40,119 had joined the Caligastia secession.
Okay, so step one is to do just what I did at the beginning. Remind you that you've got these secondary midwayers being born into this context where more than four-fifths of their immediate fellow creatures, the primary midwayers, are definitively right there working with Caligastia still. Right? I mean, very direct, mischief-making hands of Caligastia. Been working, you know, over 40,000 of them, you know, working every day, you know, day and night. They don't sleep every day for 200,000 years, or, you know, 150,000 years. You know, so there's, you know, you can imagine how sophisticated an insidious culture Caligastia and crew had developed after 150,000 years working day and night without sleep. Right? I mean, this was a complete lifestyle solution that the secondary midwayers could join. You know, it's just hard for us to, you know, wrap our minds around just how corrosive an influence that must have been on humanity. You know, it's one thing to have, Caligastia could be standing in this room. It's a complete whatever, right? I mean, can't do anything to anyone. But, you know, primary midwayers can engage matters easily as secondaries, but they can. You know, it's you know, that would have been a delight for Caligastia to have, you know, that many individuals. Not to mention, don't forget, there's also all the rebel unrevealed order of angels, you know, that are below cherubim, you know, which are more like secondary midwayers in their ability to engage material things. Right, you know, the primaries are more like, you know, cherubim, seraphim, you know. But the lesser order, see, they're going to be more parallel to secondary midwayers. And so, you know, all the rebel ones of those could have been doing all kinds of overt material mischief. All those would have been under the command of Caligastia, under the immediate command, I'm sure, of Daligastia. You know, and Abaddon, you know, the chief of staff and all that. So, you know, it would have been this whole elaborate scheme, you know, just thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of beings, tens of thousands of beings, all under the command of the still reigning planetary prince, right? He still is planetary prince. He wasn't dethroned from that until Jesus' time. So that's what they're reminding you up front. You know, and then obviously the next thing is to, okay, in that context, let's talk about the secondary midwayers. You got some?
Well, they describe them as having gone into sin. They're talking, yes, in terms of the real definition of sin.
Right, deliberate disloyalty to deity, right? They had, this wasn't default, right? I mean, like I said, they were full in, jumped in with both feet. You know, it wasn't just merely evil. You know, we're talking sin. And after all that time, you know, what initially is a conscious choice of that which is bad, you know, in the face of knowing that which is good, right? After that much time, everything flips around. And in the eyes of all those rebels, what's objectively bad looks good to them, and vice versa. So, you know, after a certain amount of time, you know, it's effectively hopeless. I mean, there's just no way to reach someone everything has been flipped, black is white and white is black. It doesn't matter how much goodness, you know, you put in front of them. I mean, initially you can put goodness in front of them and they recognize it as goodness and say, yeah, but I'm rejecting that consciously, willfully, and I'm selecting bad. But, you know, eventually you can put goodness, you know, in front of them, and that looks bad to them. You know? It just honestly looks bad to them. And so then what do you do? There's just no reaching them then.
Off with their head.
You know, that's that cosmic insanity, see, when everything is flipped 180 degrees to them. Okay. See, so that's one element to remember, see, with that. And, you know, and I mentioned that before. I mean, when they see Michael you know, the goodness of Michael looks like badness to them, and when they see the badness of Galagasha, that looks like goodness to them. Everything is flipped.
Yeah. William Otto is wondering if you might have some examples of material mischief.
I don't have any sort of specific thing in history that I would hold up as exhibit A. Just merely think of the stories that you know, the mythological stories, you know, where the spirits or the demons are engaging some king, you know, in some, you know, facilitating some machinations, right? Just recognize that some of those stories could be based on literal events. I mean, sure, they're going to be modified and aggrandized and whatnot over time, but just to recognize that you literally had such events, you know, so that, like I said, all of the notions that people had dreamt up about magic and, you know, how, you know, what you could do to make something happen magically and all this, all those midwares would just feed right into that. And the person would do the thing that magically is supposed to make something happen, and it would happen, right? Because they would just feed into that. Yeah. And so all that divination, you know, stuff.
It's like
and
that Bud Light commercial.
You know, it just.
It
would have.
They couldn't get. If you had a normal mind, unless you willed it, they couldn't.
We'll get to that in just a minute. We don't want to get into that. That's coming up here. We'll get into that whole issue about how they could engage people. But you know, independent of engaging someone literally, you know, in a possession-like, you know, fashion. I mean, just the things that they could do to the external world. Right? Okay. All right, so let's read about the secondaries here. This is another little paragraph they throw in.
The original number of secondary midwares was 1,984, and of these, 873 failed to align themselves with the rule of Michael and were duly interned in connection with the planetary adjudication of Urantia on the day of Pentecost. No one can forecast the future of these fallen creatures.
Okay, so a couple of key things. You know, them using that term there, planetary adjudication. Yes, we haven't gotten to the adjudication of the entire Lucifer Rebellion yet. But there was a very definitive, quote-unquote, right there, planetary adjudication that occurred at Pentecost. And not everything was dealt with, but a number of things on this planet were dealt with. Like they're pointing out there, all of the rebel angels, all three flavors, you know, the lesser order, the cherubim, the seraphim, and both flavors of midwares were all taken off and interned, you know, with Lucifer and the others, the other rebels there in the prison worlds around Gerasim. Okay, so there's that. And then that no one can forecast the future of these fallen creatures. So that should remind you of a similar thing. There's a whole bunch of individuals involved in the rebellion that are all just in this standby, you know, sort of mode, you know, waiting for this eventual adjudication. You know, they said a very similar thing about the 60. You know, primary 100 members of the prince's staff that joined the rebellion. You know, they became mortal, eventually died, you know, like Nod. And, you know, remember all their adjusters were left behind when they came here to join the staff, all 100 of them. You know, and they said back there when we read about the planetary rebellion that, they said, we know not the fate of the 60 staff rebels. Their adjusters still tarry on Gerasim. matters will undoubtedly rest as they now are until the entire Lucifer Rebellion is finally adjudicated and the fate of all participants decreed. So they're pointing out that in the same way that you, remember, you have these, the prince's staff, the primary 100, they're referring to there, those 60, remember, they didn't have just a little soul, quote-unquote, like we do. They had a full Marantia nature, you know, that was brought here from Gerasim. You know, so the material part dies and, you know, it's not, you know, tied to them anymore, but they still are this Marantia being, okay, that doesn't die.
Not fused.
Right, they're not fused. So, I mean, there's this Marantia being that, I see is waiting, for an adjudication. Just like all of these midwayers and angels, and, you know, none of them die. You have all of these beings, right, that at some point, you know, if the thumb goes down, the divine executioner vaporizes their body. You know, as it were, unravels their body. But in the time being, they just, they're just in waiting. Okay, so that's the whole point, that they're just tying them in with that in this kind of limbo state, if you will.
And not only them, but all the ones that since the time accepted forgiveness. Are also
right. They mentioned that you have. I mean, yeah, on a whole bunch of people, you know, that did, you know, kind of stumble into the rebellion on various worlds and on Gerasim, you know, have since, you know, yeah. Sincerely apologized. You know, I was like, oh, okay, I was just totally misled, and they were. You know, they're innocent underlings that were just following orders, and and they finally saw the light. But see. Whether or not they're reminding you here, even those who never saw the light, you know, that stuck to it and are still, they're just in waiting for the Ancients of Days to finally do the full adjudication of the whole local system rebellion, not these sort of partial planetary adjudications like we got 2,000 years ago. Okay, now the other thing there is the numbers. Now, you notice they're making a point here of giving you numbers because they want you to reflect on all of these ratios, rebel ratios, okay? So, start with the, so remember that the prince's staff, you have the 100 primary ones that came from Gerasim and were given corporeal bodies. Then you have the 100... and the knights who were modified and made immortal as well. Okay. Out of those modified and the knights, remember 44 out of the 100 joined the rebellion. Okay? So a little bit more than 2/5. Okay? And then with the primary 160 out of the 100 joined the rebellion. So, 3/5. And then here with the primary midwayers, a little more than 4/5. Notice the, right? 2/5, 3/5, 4/5. The higher the spiritual nature, the higher the fraction joined the rebellion. Right, the more material, like the mind, the more lowly the mind, the more kind of innately humble the mind. Right, you make them more spiritual, you know, and in a very definitive fashion, it goes from 2/5 to 3/5 to 4/5. Right, when they're more spiritual, it's much easier for someone with more spiritual consciousness to delusionally exalt their self, okay, to be prideful. Pride goeth before a fall. Okay, so the thing between the lines, right? That goes beyond just a history lesson, facts about history. What's the truth flowing through these paragraphs? Right? How's it relative to you? Right? It's what you've heard me say a million times. Right? It's not the very prosaic material consciousness, you know, individual that's a frustrating boat anchor to progress. That's not the problem on the planet. Right? It's not an emergency, you know, that you have individuals like that. It's the fact that you have more and more spiritually conscious people. That's what produces an emergency, because the more spiritually conscious you are in your ignorance, the more you will unwittingly join the rebellion. It'll go from 2/5 to 3/5 to 4/5, right? As you go from material to moronical to spiritual, right? With those three, okay? That's the lesson, right? As we say so often, to him who much is given is much expected, right? If you're going to be given more spiritual consciousness, if you think spirit's innately divine, right, you'll be part of the crew going from 3/5, right, to 4/5.
This risks derailing us, so I'll leave that to you. But I was thinking, can we say, I was always struck by, again, the liberty aspect of the Lucifer Manifesto, and then we see in our own country in 1776, liberty being one of those values. And that always struck me, because it's not all bad, but is that an example of what we're talking about?
Liberty, liberty is a spirit word.
Okay.
Right? It's an inner life word. You know, it's a word of your spiritualized mind in the upper domain of your hourglass analogy of your mind. Okay. Right? It's a spirit word. When you apply that down to your adjutant, you know, your mere adjutant mind and out to the world, to the physical things, liberty is is expressed relative to freedom. Freedom is the word that describes, freedom of your basic intellect, you know, or literally, do you have shackles on? Okay? But liberty is a spirit word, you know, and you take a hold of that spirit word when you have some spiritual consciousness, but then your responsibility has to kick in. You have to see to whether or not your liberty is true liberty or false liberty. You know, and you see, your relationship to the Father gives you liberty, but your relationship to the Mother determines whether it's true liberty or false liberty. So that's, we've talked about that over and over again. You know, what do they say back there in the Lucifer Rebellion? There's been no problem, right, greater than that inability to distinguish between true and false liberty. That's the core problem.
The relationship to the whole.
Right. Is you discover your liberty as a part. Now, do you put that part in the context of the whole, or do you see yourself as a whole unto yourself? Right? Do you ismize yourself? And that's that was, you know, what Lucifer preached, and everyone got excited about. Anyone with a spiritual consciousness, all you have to do is say the word liberty and you can feel the burning. It's a powerful, exciting thought to even put in your mind. It is so animated. And you can't help yourself. You just want to act upon that. You go tearing off for the horizon, motivated by that recognition of liberty. And if you don't have yourself in cooperative subordination to the whole, you will slam into the wall with that motivation.
Give me liberty or give me a gun.
give me liberty or give me death. No, see, it's actually give me liberty and then I can really die. Right? It's when you're given liberty, there's real danger. Until you have liberty, you can't really die. You don't have a relationship to reality, so you can't really die. Take a hold of liberty, and you can affect your relationship to eternity. Freedom is just about time. You know, for the current time, you're a slave or whatever. Liberty is what's tying, you know, about issues, how you relate to eternity, not just about time. So it has real consequences, you know, if that liberty is false. Okay, so see, that's the key lesson, that you take these individuals that are, you know, very, very close to us, the modified Adonites, right? And then as you move away from kind of where we are to more spiritual consciousness, but yet quite similar to us, right? You see this greater and greater fraction were delusional, you know, exalted themselves, fell in love with themselves, the liberty of that self, and ran with it, unfortunately. Now, the interesting thing, okay, when we've got the final tally back at, you know, Pentecost, like I said, when all the secondary midwayers were sat down, okay, you got to make your final choice. 873 said, no, rebellion, that's for me. So do the math. 873 divided by 1984. Very interesting what the fraction is. 44%. Exactly the same as the modified Adonites. 44 of the 100. It's the exact same percentage. See, so it shows you how close secondary midwayers are to us, that their ratio is exactly what the modified Adonites was, 44%. Isn't that interesting? I mean, it's, you know, it's spot on, 44%. So you can see the mathematics is quite tight. You know, and then, of course, I've already mentioned, you know, before, back when we talked about the planetary rebellion, you know, what, you know, Jesus said in response to Peter that time, you know, where he says that division can only be the result where two members of a family believe in me and three members reject this gospel. Right, when he gave that mathematics, the two-fifths, three-fifths. Right, exactly what happened with the primary 100, you know, where three-fifths joined the rebellion. So Jesus is just reminding us of this very definitive mathematics here that's played out on this planet, kind of giving you the center point there. And you go a little more spiritual, it goes to four-fifths, a little less spiritual, it goes to two-fifths. There was a question over here? Okay.
Certainly points out how, I mean, they had this physics. Well, a rebellion on that world with midwayers, we can already know how that's going to go.
Right. It's just very fascinating. See, it reminds you of just how, like I've said so many times, there's a lot of things that we think is all about our free will. It's not, okay? Your free will is not in play. You're a mathematical formula playing out. Sure, it's very sophisticated. It's a lot fancier than a dirt clod, okay? But basic physics of energy is all that's happening there. And when you don't have the objective oversight and control of it, there's a certain physics, the energy system, that just naturally plays out. And you get these ratios like this. All right, so that's the lesson. That's how they start out this little history lesson with two little paragraphs that, when you reflect on it, you know, give you the immediate usefulness of what we're studying here to us, especially us since the middle of the 20th century. When evolution has led to the leading edge of mankind having enough spiritual consciousness sort of just innately, that someone can stumble into the philosophic space of the Lucifer Rebellion, right? That you can stumble out of all of the foolishness of the ghost cult, you know, notions, you know, where sin is transgression of taboo, and taboo is all the, you know, evolutionary notions that, you know, humans have had. You can stumble out of that world into the real world because you have enough spirit nature. You know, and the first thing you do in that ignorance when you're stumbling like that is you stumble right into the Lucifer rebellion. And that's why there's an emergency, because we have a lot of people that have been primed by the Father but have no contexting from the Mother, and they've stumbled right into the beginnings of the Lucifer rebellion, and civilization is in jeopardy now. Okay, give us another little tidbit here.
Both groups of rebel midwares are now held in custody, awaiting the final adjudication of the affairs of the system rebellion. But they did many strange things on Earth prior to the inauguration of the present planetary dispensation.
Okay, so that first sentence, and we saw them saying that about when I went back and read about the 60, you know, rebel staff members. Everything is waiting for the system rebellion to be adjudicated. But there they repeat it. You know, before they said mischief. Okay, here it's the classic that I so often toss out there. But they did many strange things on Earth, right, prior to Pentecost. And, you know, you're just left to, you know, to investigate history with a new eye to these facts and go, do you suppose that isn't just a story? Okay. It's just like when they, you know, tell you about some of these things and you go back and you reread Daniel, you know, and you look at some passages and I say, oh, wait a minute, that's probably not just a story made up there. That's actually probably the secondary midwares working with Daniel, the writing on the wall things, you know. Right, that Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. You know, you suddenly see that in what you could just dismiss as a bunch of made-up, you know, events, it's like, no, that's the most very likely the midwares. Right, they can, you know, they can pick up some sort of writing utensil, and you can't, you know, they don't have to make themselves visible, and they can write on a wall. Right? Or they can roll the stone away from the tomb. They don't have to make themselves visible. You know, they can do those things. Right? And the loyal midwares are working with, you know, the planetary administration, you know, whether it's way back in Daniel's time or now. You know, that whole bit of, you know, and especially when you think about just how anything goes, you know, it's going to be hard to look at any story and say, well, that's completely impossible. That's just a bunch of fantasies about the doings of so-called ghosts. I mean, those rebel secondaries, I mean, you know, as they'll mention a little bit, remember they're sort of quasi-power beings, right? They're not merely like the lesser order of angels, you know, which are, you know, more just on the personality side of the power personality duality. Right? They have a definitive power being side. So the strange things are, you know, are not just mind engagement of another individual. We're talking literal stuff with matter, like I've been saying. Who knows what they might have done? You know, if they can move that big stone front of the tomb, I mean, you know, and that kind of sounds like I was probably trivial. I mean, how big of things could they move? Right? You know, you're left to just go back. You know, that's what they're encouraging us to do. I mean, they obviously weren't allowed to give us any exhibit A's, like I was saying before, right? But you can go back and study and think about it. And
well, if a mustard seed worth of faith can move a mountain.
Yeah. And then if you're a power being on top of it, you might be able to literally move a mountain. Yeah. So, many strange things. Like I said, just, you know, one of the very first things that you're suspicious of is, you know, maybe not so much, you know, things like the pyramids, which are sort of just like on the beginning edge of exactly how did they, you know, what was the logistics for moving all those stones and stuff. Now, go to the stuff where you got bigger stones. There's some megalithic things on the planet. Very mysterious how humans could have been, you know, manipulating those such massive stones. But it would have been child's play, probably, see, for the midwares. Okay. Let's see. All right. So now, you know, we're going to get into a little bit more of this question we're wondering about. It's like, well, what about, dealing more directly with humans, right? And, you know, and getting towards the stuff that you know is going on back in Jesus' day, you know, with so-called demon possessions, you know, and this sort of stuff. So let's see what else they say here.
These disloyal midwares were able to reveal themselves to mortal eyes under certain circumstances, and especially was this true of the associates of Beelzebub, the leader of the apostate secondary midwares. But these unique creatures must not be confused with certain of the rebel cherubim and seraphim, who also were on earth up to the time of Christ's death and resurrection. Some of the older writers designated these rebellious midway creatures as evil spirits and demons, and the apostate seraphim as evil angels.
Okay, so several things there. First of all, you know, as they start out there, I've already said it several times, you know, they reveal themselves to mortal eyes under certain circumstances. Well, yeah, the primaries, you know, have that whole kind of under certain circumstances. We don't quite know what the limitations are. That's always, you know, we've run into that mystery several times with the primaries. But with the secondaries, as they say there, okay, I mean, this is straightforward. I mean, it's just, they just make themselves manifest any time they want. There's no sort of special circumstances to it at all. You know, and then to learn that, you know, what they're saying is that there was a leader of the apostate secondary midwares. He, you know, very likely, you know, manifested himself to a lot of humans back in the day, and he came to be called Beelzebub. Right, that human name is not, I mean, this is a case where, you know, it's not that the rebels are saying, well, you've got that name, let's apply that to the leader of the secondary, rebel secondary midwares. You know, they seem to be saying here, it's like, no, the humans gave him that name because they actually interacted with him. And he came to be known that, the Lord of the Flies. Okay. So, see, that's an interesting twist on it. You know, unlike them just using the name Lucifer or Satan, you know, for, you know, here, right, they're telling you, you have this name that the Hebrews, you know, used, and that's actually referring to that being. You named him that. You know, actually he's, you know, you know, DEF the 12th or something, right? Or whatever. I mean, who knows which one he is, okay? But you know, that's an interesting little tidbit. You know? Or, you know, he also is called Beelzebul. But, You know, or sometimes it's spelled with two A's instead of two E's, you know, Baal, Baalzebub instead of Beelzebub. But anyway, you know, in other words, that's not a made-up thing in the Bible. That's a historical figure. That was a secondary midware, right? That was an imaginary god or something, or, you know, spirit being or something. Then, you know, think about a little bit right after that. But these unique creatures must not be confused with certain of the rebel cherubim and seraphim, who were also on earth up to the time. You're going, well, wait a minute. Okay, why would I be confusing secondary midwayers with cherubim and seraphim? I could imagine I might be confusing primary rebel primary midwayers with rebel cherubim and seraphim, but, oh... Remember, they're not allowed to talk about the lesser order of angels. But often they say something like that where it doesn't quite make sense. And you scratch your head. It's like, oh, yeah, right. Don't confuse the rebel secondary midwayers with a rebel lower order of angels, unrevealed order of angels, like I was saying a little bit ago. Right? There would be lots. You only have 1,984 secondary midwares total. I mean, how many of those lesser angels were on the planet at the time of rebellion? Could have been hundreds of thousands of them. I mean, think how many rebel ones of those there might have been.
I suppose that ratio follows the same.
Yeah. Right? So, see, that's what's between the lines. They're just reminding you about what they can't talk about. Don't, you know, remember that you've got that other order of angels that we just occasionally, indirectly allude to, because we're not allowed to talk about them, that would have been doing secondary midware-type foolishness also, right? That can also engage material things very directly. At the very least... make themselves visible. I mean, maybe they aren't as power being like as a secondary midware, but nonetheless, that's what they're hinting at there. Like I've said already, you've got them all being taken off at Pentecost, and you know, in the Bible, you'll see. Sometimes they'll talk about demons. Sometimes they'll call them devils. And here they're just reminding you that your first thought is, you know, that might be a genuinely rebel secondary midware. But could also be a rebel lower angel. Would fall into that same category. All right. I don't know, every time I read it, it just feels sad to even think about it. Apostate seraphim, it's just such a harsh contrast. We tend to think of an angel as such a divine creature. It just reminds you, they're not that different than we are. just all of these evil angels that were running around, you know, even seraphim. It's just so sad to think of all of them, you know, following the orders of Caligash and Dalagash and doing all sorts of nasty things.
No wonder we were isolated.
You imagine coming to visit this world, right? Back then. Yeah, and you've got to deal with just hundreds and hundreds of thousands of rebel beings, you know, coming at you. It reminds you of, when we talk about Adam and Eve, you know, and there's Caligash, you know, talking in their face, you know, all the time. Well, that's, you know, hundreds of thousands of all these rebel angels, you know, hanging out at the first garden. And all, you know, just imagine that. They can see them all, hear them all. Yeah. I mean, just what a circus it would have been. just ridiculous to even think about. I mean, how could you even think straight with that many? You know, all you know, they don't sleep.
Had good ones too.
They had good ones too, but I mean, you wonder. It's like, well, did they get some help for, you know? Occasionally, they put up the force fields, and it's like, yeah. They just keep them out so that you had a breather for a while.
You look at the numbers, you wonder how they even kept the tree of life.
Yeah.
Because the numbers were against them.
Yeah.
So there must be something more to it.
Yeah, right. We don't. Yeah, we've talked about that before. We don't quite understand the dynamics of this, but.
Do you think the good ones could, the loyal ones could have acted as guards or something, or have somehow, you know, shunted them?
Yeah, I mean, you get the idea, like, you know, when Jesus drives out the rebel secondary midwayer and he calls on a loyal one to not let him get back in. You know, you get the sense that they're, you know, I mean, there's probably some sort of like-to-like blocking ability, but again, we don't know what kind of physics we're talking about. You know, so we end up, I'm sure, grossly anthropomorphizing it, you know, exactly how it works. Right, you know, yeah, we immediately envision, you know, spears and swords and, you know, or martial arts or whatever, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I just picture a pushing contest.
But, yeah, I mean, obviously there's going to be some sort of, you know, because they're just as literal beings as we are. It's not like, you know, a seraphim can't hug each other. Right, or something. I mean, they can engage each other. So, all that stuff we've talked about so many times ever since we first read about the, you know, rebellion, you know, on Gerasim and wondering about how they were blocking people and stuff. And all that weird stuff is in play. But you know, the obvious thing that they're just saying, you know, your older writers, is just what I was saying. You know, they're encouraging you to go back and reread everything, you know, and think about it anew. Don't be so dismissive, because many strange things. I mean, if you're reading about something post-Pentecost, okay, you can be pretty dismissive, right? You know, no, that wasn't really demons, you know, as they're about to explain. But prior to Pentecost, I mean, just about anything is possible. It's going to be very difficult to just look at some of those stories and say, oh, that's just a made-up thing. Nothing like that remotely happened. Are you sure?
Good example. When Jesus, with Peter, when he says, the enemy wanted you, but I didn't. And that could have been what he was being set up there with the fire three times. To, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah.
And that could have been an incident. That being the enemy trying to negotiate the situation to have him fall.
Yeah.
I just thought of this too. It gives an added dimension to somebody like Alexander the Great or something, these big political figures that
mm-hmm.
did these sweeping empires. And who knows what other things were at play.
Remember, there's even a story of a mysterious craft hovering over one of Alexander's battles.
That one.
Right. I see all kinds of things are possible. You know, see, remember, you can, you know, like I've pointed out, you can even take it up another notch. Right? Sometime back in there, I mean, I think that because you have so few loyal individuals to work with and you need a lot of helping hands, that they are other inhabited world in this solar system with the non-breathers, you know. They brought some of them in to help, and okay, the non-breathers have advanced technology. I mean, they have, you know, they have anti-gravity craft that can fly from the outer solar system to here, and right. I mean, you know, so at some point you're going to bring in all of that into play with this stuff too. So again, it's almost about anything goes, right? It's hard to limit, you know, and even now. Even post-Pentecost, okay, you don't have any rebel stuff going on, but the above-board stuff, again, has lots of possibilities. You know, you need to be cautious about just immediately dismissing something. It's like, well, okay, is that remotely possible?
Eisenhower shaking.
right. You can start to wonder. It's like, oh, maybe that was a secondary midware in that story, you know, from 50 years ago or whatever. Yeah. Okay. All right. So now they're going to get, like I was saying, you know, first you have sort of kind of just picturing kind of face-to-face engagement between secondary midwares and humans. You know, what about this engaging them mindily thing?
On no world can evil spirits possess any mortal mind subsequent to the life of a paradise bestowal son, but before the days of Christ Michael on Urantia, before the universal coming of the thought adjusters and the pouring out of the master spirit upon all flesh, these rebel midwares were actually able to influence the minds of certain inferior mortals and somewhat to control their actions. This was accomplished in much the same way as the loyal midway creatures function when they serve as efficient contact guardians of the human minds of the Urantia Reserve Corps of Destiny at those times when the adjuster is, in effect, detached from the personality during a season of contact with superhuman intelligences.
Okay, again, you know, we don't understand all the physics here, but you know, let's just start with the latter half of that paragraph, you know, where they're bringing in how the similarities to what goes on all the time with the Destiny reservists. So in other words, even though we don't understand the details, right, there obviously is a way that secondary midwares are able to quite effectively directly engage the mind energy of a mortal. Okay, we need to. They're going to give us a little bit more on the limitations. We're not going to unpack all the limitations quite yet. We need to get a couple more paragraphs here first. Okay, but that's the main point. You know, just you know, they're basically saying, remember how we tell you later in the book about the Destiny Reservists and how the secondary midwares are indispensable to that process of they can engage the mind of the mortal and help to interface with other celestials via the self-acting adjuster, you know, feeding things into the mind and all this. You know one reason why this makes sense. Because remember, the secondary midwares don't just have Urantia mind for their mindal self. They have the sixth and seventh adjutants also. Okay. So that's the immediate like-to-like energy, mind energy engagement possibility. They have a direct interface potential at the top of your adjutant mindal nature. And they can't, you know, engage you first down at the basement, first adjutant level, but they can engage the ceiling of, you know, of your mere adjutant mind nature. Okay? Because they have the sixth and seventh adjutants also. And it's not obvious here yet, they'll explain that in a minute. The key thing that they're talking about in the first half of the paragraph there that changed at Pentecost, the thought adjusters are a secondary issue. The fundamental thing that changed the situation is the spirit of truth, not the thought adjusters. It's the spirit of truth that made it so that on no world can evil spirits possess any mortal mind subsequent. It's the pouring out of the spirit of truth. And I'll explain precisely in a little bit about that. And remember, they teed that up, you know, and they're saying evil spirits there. They're meaning, you know, like they said, evil spirits, demons, secondary midwares. Right? Those that actually have that ability to kind of be at eye level with your mind, as opposed to a primary midwayer that has angelic type mind, you know, that's above adjutant mind. So, I mean, they don't have a direct eye level mind energy interface potential with you like a secondary does. Yep.
Okay, so if an evil spirit can't do it, but a non-evil spirit can do it, there must be something in the physics of being evil.
I'm gonna get to the physics here in just a little bit, but yeah, you see, your gears start turning. It's like, well, exactly how do I understand how this works? Like I said, let's get a little bit more. Okay. They give us some more clues, and then we can put it together and figure out exactly what the deal is here. Because you know, they give you very vague things here to start with. They say these rebel midwares, you know, rebel secondary midwares, were actually able to influence the minds of certain inferior mortals and somewhat to control their actions. It's like, well, okay, so kind of fuzzy words. You know, what do they mean by certain inferior and somewhat control? Let's see if we can figure that out when they give us some more clues here. Okay, let's read some more.
It is no mere figure of speech when the record states, and they brought to him all sorts of sick peoples, those who were possessed by devils and those who were lunatics. Jesus knew and recognized the difference between insanity and demoniacal possession. Although these states were greatly confused in the minds of those who lived in his day and generation.
So that right there you see them, you know, saying devils instead of demons. Right, so, you know, when you've got that passage in Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, right, it's no mere figure of speech. Right, it literally was the case that you had individuals who were being somewhat controlled, as they just said, by a rebel secondary midwayer. Like, okay. Again, what's the exact physics of this? We need one more paragraph before we get that. They're about to explain it. You know, they're teeing it up right there. The lunatics, quote unquote. Post Pentecost, no matter how much it seems that the only way that you could possibly explain some weird thing that's happening to someone and they have to bring in an exorcist or whatever, there's no actual rebel being engaging there. Right? That's the fact that we think that the only way to explain that is there must be some other being possessing that person just reminds you of how, like I say so many times, how poor our assumptions are about how much you can do with your own mind, just how sophisticated your mind is, how fancy the manifestations it's capable of just in and of itself.
Especially with all the medication.
Okay. So, they're about to make that point. Humans, you could say, well, yeah, but it's just adjutant mind. Well, it's just the mind of the creative mother spirit. Gee, that doesn't sound so limiting when I say it that way. Right, I mean, it can very, very sophisticated things can be manifested. Even with merely adjutant mind, you know, you can make it seem, we've talked about this many times, it's very easy for you to subjectively produce a vivid island of heat in your mind that is subjectively indistinguishable with what it would be like if your adjuster actually engaged you in a way that you noticed. I mean, you can imitate an adjuster with your mind. You can imitate any being, you know, any rebel midwayer engaging you. You can imitate anything, you know, basically with your mind. Your mind is a very sophisticated instrument. And you have to keep that in mind. All right, pardon the bun. All right, it's just... Yeah, and humans, the Revelators try to make this point many times. You know, humans have never assumed that you could do this something that sophisticated yourself. You've always said, well, that's got to be a celestial, or that's got to be God, you know, or whatever, engaging that human. No, it doesn't have to be at all. That should never be your first assumption, that a third, you know, there's a literal third person involved, you know, in the process. Start with, you know, Occam's razor. Assume it's you first. Okay. All right, so now, like I said, they're about to give a little bit more precise thing that we can, something we can work with here to try to sort this out, exactly how this works.
Even prior to Pentecost, no rebel spirit could dominate a normal human mind. And since that day, even the weak minds of inferior mortals are free from such possibilities. The supposed casting out of devils since the arrival of the Spirit of Truth has been a matter of confounding a belief in demoniacal possession with hysteria, insanity, and feeble-mindedness. But just because Michael's bestowal has forever liberated all human minds on Urantia from the possibility of demoniacal possession, do not imagine that such was not a reality in former ages.
Okay, so there you can start to see, it seems like it's the Spirit of Truth and not the thought adjuster that's the key thing. They make that solid in the final paragraph. So, supposed casting out a devil since the arrival of the Spirit of Truth. Yeah, okay, like I've been saying, no, it's not any sort of a genuine quote-unquote possession sort of a thing. Okay, so what about? What about before Pentecost? You know, so they start out, even prior to Pentecost, no rebel spirit could dominate a normal human mind. Okay, so just pause there. There's a very important word in there. And dominate. Okay? So, you know, that makes you think back. Okay, somewhat to control their actions. What the qualification is about. Okay? And again, you know, it's easy to, you know, to visualize with the hourglass analogy of your mind or self. Right? By grace, you have an upper domain, because you've been encircled in the Holy Spirit, and a personality is identified with that, you know, that selfhood, that encirclement. Okay, that's that spiritualized mind innately dominates the unspiritualized mind below. Right, all the way to your free will, right, and your sovereignty up there. Okay, you know, as long as we're talking about a blob of protoplasm that's shaped, you know, roughly like me, that is genuinely human, right? So that there's a spiritualized mind, there's a personality, right? No other personality can push that totally aside, you know, and completely dominate the animal origin, agitant, mindal self in the lower domain, you know, which is what makes your body move and stuff. Okay? That associating mechanism in the lower domain that links to the external world. All right, so you control their actions. Yeah, you know, we're talking about, you know, external world physical actions there. So, I mean, there's, you don't have to have the Spirit of Truth for it to be impossible for another being to literally dominate like that. Okay. But, as they said, certain inferior mortals, if you get someone that's, you know, has such a limited personal nature, right, that it's, you know, there's just sort of this fragmented, you know, minimal, you know, control top down of the human over the animal origin mind, those secondary midwayers could get in there and muck around a little bit. Okay, and now specifically how there. Okay, remember they only have the sixth and seventh adjutants. So they don't have all seven. They can't, they have no way of engaging you in an adjutant sense in a holistic way. They're very limited, you know, to part-wise engagement relative to your adjutant mind, because they only have two of the seven adjutants. So what's the deal with the Spirit of Truth? Okay, it's not as the Spirit of Truth, that spirit ministry, but it's that foundational, more immediate spirit energy influence of that ministry as the Spirit of Unification. Yeah, remember how on the chart here, the threefold actualities of unity, I have that, you know, little addition there by the Spirit of Truth, you know, parenthetically, unification, right? The Spirit of that ministry functioning is a spirit of unification. The reason that things change once you have the Spirit of Truth poured out, functioning as a spirit of unification. Okay, normally, remember, you can't get an adjutant until, you know, you're effectively a third circler. Okay, what's the deal in going from a seventh circler to a third circler? It's starting with your seven adjutants functioning like seven parts as a seventh circler. Getting up to third circler where you have that initial unification of them. You have them all sort of fully ramped up and hence innately coordinatable. And so you have that initial, you know, just automatic then unification of your adjutant mind. And going from third circler to first circler is finishing that, you know, bringing that unification to completeness, where effectively you don't have seven parts anymore, you just have one part, and then you can transfer over to a one-part mind, your Marantia mind. Okay? It's that, it's the unification thing of a third circler. What does the Spirit of Truth, functioning as a spirit of unification, do for you? Right as a seventh circler, you can get an adjuster. Right? There's enough unified nature to your mind that an adjuster can relate to it. It doesn't have to wait for the third circler. Well, now what's the difference between the kind of unification that a third circler has relative to a seventh circler with the Spirit of Truth, functioning as a spirit of unification? With a third circler, that unification is conscious. Your conscious mind is in, you know, functions, you know, in that unified sense. But right now, right, you know, as a roughly 6 years old, and you got the Spirit of Truth functioning as a spirit of unification engaging you, super consciously, there was a third circular like unification in your mind. Not consciously, you're not a third circular, but super consciously, that unification is there. So an adjuster could come. But set adjusters aside, that's not the relevant, you know, right here, right, once you have that, doesn't have to be conscious, that, but that unification of the mind, the midwayer can't engage it anymore. He needs the innately part-like state. Okay? So that unification is like a shield then, see? It's not like to like anymore, and the secondary midwayer can't interface with it, effectively blocked out. That's the physics of what's going on. But when you've got someone before Pentecost, see, that doesn't just by grace have that super conscious unification of their mind, it could very well be in a quite part-like mode if there's, you know, in many ways, it's as if they don't have any personality, you know, exerting an over-control over the adjutant mind. This is so minimal, right? In that inferior mortal, right, that in many ways it's functioning in part-like fashion, and hence, you know, it's a divide-and-conquer situation, right? Your mind is divided and can be somewhat conquered, as they say there, somewhat controlled. That's what the deal is. Yeah. So now, since that day, even the weak minds of inferior mortals, so, you know, it can be the lowliest human, right, in terms of their conscious nature, but by grace, superconsciously, still there's this unification. And so even if there were rebel secondaries here, they couldn't engage such an individual. Now notice there's something that hasn't been said that's right under the surface of everything we're talking about. Well, what about if they're a blob of protoplasm shaped roughly like me, but like say they're so inferior that the seventh adjutant couldn't engage? So there was no encirclement of the Holy Spirit. There's no personality engagement. They're just a fancy animal. The secondary midwares have no issues there, right? Whether it's a fancy animal, you know, that looks like a human, right? That's actually subhuman, or any animal, cat, dog, pig, horse, you know, insect, Lord of the Flies. Right, they could control flies. Right, they could engage locusts and use them as weapons.
So some of these creepy movies aren't so
bad. Right, they could control, and there's nothing blocking them from controlling any animal and doing anything with any animal. Right, including subhuman individuals. You know, which, you know, even today there are. You know, so it's fortunate, the fact that there's still subhumans on the planet, you know, because we didn't have Adam and Eve, you know, seeing to the eventual elimination of all that like they should have. In fact, we don't have any rebel secondary midwares or those lesser angels either, for that matter. It means that even them, even the subhumans on the planet, you know, there's no reality to demoniacal possession there. Because Kalgashi, Dalgashi, and the other higher beings that are still here, they have no ability to control animals. Right? They don't have adjutant mind. But, you know, you really wonder, I mean, just what... you talk about strange things, you know. What might they have done with animals, and see the mythologies that would have developed from that? And, you know, so both inanimate and animate, you know, both the rocks and the animals could have been doing all sorts of strange things.
I mean, there's a biblical story of 42 bears attacking some kids who insulted Elijah or something.
Yeah, all right, see again, you're just left to wonder, like, wow, okay, maybe those aren't all just stories. What on, you know, and were there limits to this? I mean, I don't know. I mean, who knows what the physics of all this is? But anyway, that's what's in play here. Just how strange this was, but just how powerful it is, completely unconsciously, that you have this encirclement of the Holy Spirit and stuff. You know, maybe you've gone through your whole life oblivious. You know, you haven't taken delight in cultivating at all. You know, you're very much just about the immediacies of, you know, material doings in front of you. Whether it's for selfish ends or feelingful ends or whatever it is, but you're just all about material stuff. And, you know, so... You know, you don't recognize how much you are predicated on the grace of that encirclement, you know, how much you have that little modicum of common sense that constrains your actions a little bit. You know, usually you don't jump off a cliff, you know, just because you wonder what would happen. You have enough causes. Oh, if I jump off a cliff, I fall and I die. You know, so you don't jump off a cliff. You know, I mean, that's because you have encirclement of the Holy Spirit. You have the first cosmic intuition. Right? You have a basic recognition of causality. Right? And so when you get that wild hair, it's like, I wonder what it'd be like if I did it like in Bugs Bunny and actually ran off the cliff. You know, why doesn't every human not do that? Right? Because we were predicated on this grace, you know, and just how powerful that grace is when you think about it in these terms. Even if there were rebel secondary midwares, right, they couldn't dominate your mind. Just because of that part of you that you're oblivious to, because it's sad to record, right, that you haven't taken delight in cultivating. The grace is there nonetheless, no matter how oblivious you are to it. So, okay, so...
it teaches us we have to become like-minded. We have to become more like God to ever even have a possibility of having a true divine, maybe not just the basic relationship, but to be in the presence and to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, you know, we were talking about the true and false liberty thing, and I mentioned liberty comes from the fact that one of your parents is the universal father, and the true or false part is relative to your other parent, the universal mother. To keep in mind that. You know, that you need to have that that dual relationship, you know, in everything that you attempt to understand, you know, in terms of what it means to be more godlike, right? There's not just God the Father; there's also God the Mother. You know, and be, you know, there's a negative side to being too merely God the Father-like, as it were, see? Right? There needs to be a balance there. You know, you have this individual who's a, you know, literally an expression of the descending ministry of the Universal Father, a Lananandek. Right? And he goes... into rebellion. See, it's not enough to just, you know, even to be literally, you know, a direct ministry coming down from the Universal Father. It needs to be put in the context of the Mother. Right? Like I said, the very first thing that the Universal Father did when he came into existence was put himself in cooperative subordination to that which is greater than him, the whole, the Paradise Trinity. Right? All parts must be in the context of the whole, or the part goes astray. It's the whole that makes you whole, see? Right? That prevents you from becoming iniquitous. If the Father hadn't done that initially, he would have instantaneously become an infinite iniquity. Just, you have to be in the context of the whole.
And that is... what they give us in this revelation, the facts, and the ability to see the truth flowing through that.
Yeah, again, remember the literalness of the word iniquity, right? It's not equity, not synchronized with the whole. That's what the word means. It doesn't mean apart from the Father. It means apart from the whole. Yeah, that's what it means. You know, in the same sense, it's not deliberate disloyalty to God. It's deliberate disloyalty to deity. Right? Right? That which transcends the parts, right? The context for the parts, that's what's the key. That's what will make you whole inside, and that's what will give your life meaning. Nothing else. Did you have something?
No.
Okay. Then. All right, let's see if we can get a little bit more here.
The entire group of rebel midwares is at present held prisoner by order of the Most Highs of Edentia. No more do they roam this world on mischief bent. Regardless of the presence of the thought adjusters, the pouring out of the Spirit of truth upon all flesh forever made it impossible for disloyal spirits of any sort or description ever again to invade even the most feeble of human minds. Since the day of Pentecost, there never again can be such a thing as demoniacal. That's the fourth time of possession. I should have it down by now.
You just have to follow all the letters. It's like paradisiacal, you know, it's a similar sort of a, you know, construct. See, there you see it, regardless of the presence of the thought adjuster. See, it's not the thought adjuster. That's not the relevant issue. It's that
human mind.
It's that spirit of unification. And you notice, now you notice how, it says human minds. Like I said, the subhuman minds, right, there would be an issue if you had rebel secondaries. But when you think about the reservists and what they were, alluding to, so it's in the context of a unification of the mind that, remember how with a reservist, regardless of what circle they are, they have a personal pair of angels, right? They're not part of a group, right? And they have a self-acting adjuster. There's no possibility for someone to even be a Destiny reservist. They don't have a self-acting adjuster. But all of that is just, set aside the immediate things that, are mentioned. Just, what's the physics context that all that makes all that possible? It's this, you've got an individual that has this domain of requisite harmony in which parts can function in a coordinated fashion, this fancy fashion of educating the super consciousness of a reservist and all this sort of stuff, all that fancy stuff they talk about. And it all is predicated on that that unification, that requisite unification context, that the secondary midwayer is working within, and the adjuster is working within, and all that. This passage, they give you just enough clues. See that if you reflect on it, you can finally put it together. And if you wonder about, where did you come up with the spirit of truth is also the spirit of unification? Go up there and read about the spirit of truth, and you'll notice, they give a pair of basic comments about its nature, right? And all it takes is a little reflection. It's like, what would I call it functioning in that other mode where it isn't, immediately about truth? That essence of the whole that you're synchronizing with. And that's how I coined the spirit of unification. And you can see how appropriate it is. It just fits exactly into describing that aspect. There's enough unification innately in the mind there that there can be a unification between a seventh circler and a thought adjuster. Right? Like I said, those two parts can exist in a coordinated space, and have an intimate association. If there isn't a context, there can't be any engagement between those two parts, you and the adjuster. Right? This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole, and through the individuality of the whole. Right? There has to be that harmony context, that unified context, for there to be a coordination of parts within that context. Right? There's no magic. Okay. Let's read a little bit about the United Midwayers here.
8. The United Midwayers. At the last adjudication of this world, when Michael removed the slumbering survivors of time, the midway creatures were left behind, left to assist in the spiritual and semi-spiritual work on the planet. They now function as a single corps, embracing both orders and numbering 10,992. The United Midwares of Urantia are at present governed alternately by the senior member of each order. This regime has obtained since their amalgamation into one group shortly after Pentecost.
Okay, so they're kind of hinting at the title of the next section, right? Permanent citizens. Now, left behind, it's like, well, okay, I mean, they're the permanent citizens. You know, it's more like the permanent citizens are going to remain the permanent citizens. They're not going to be taken off. All the rebels were taken off, yes. But the non-rebels are right where they're supposed to be.
It just makes you wonder, I mean, if, wouldn't just being removed from a place where you were supposed to be permanent trigger something? I think I screwed up here.
Again, like I said, we just can't imagine how sophisticated the rationalization scheme Caligastia has constructed for them, where this all seems to make sense.
So right? We're being promoted. We got higher duties.
Yeah. So this is, all right. So rebels were taken off. Lots of people were part of a dispensational resurrection, but permanent citizens are permanent citizens. And we've got these 10,992 of them. We were supposed to have a lot more, but but that's what we've got. Like I said, that's because we were supposed to have so many more. That's why you're suspicious about bringing in the non-breathers. Okay. And that this fact that the very literal fact that we call them primaries and secondaries, but they don't. Primaries aren't looking down their noses at the secondaries. All the primaries put themselves under the leadership of a secondary alternatively here. Okay, so, So they very much see themselves on equal footing in that regard, despite their differences. All right.
Thought, John?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, I'm kind of putting together a couple of things. It says, we could also we could potentially create a similar being in the future. They seem to apply. And such a phenomenon was never possible on Earth before that time, nor has it ever occurred since in referring to the creation of old groups. So who knows?
Well, much further in the future, when you see seeming kind of loose ends, in the way revelators speak like that, remember when they're if they're being quite precise, they aren't absolutists, right? They know that as you go forward in the future, especially deep into the future, who knows what's going to be going on in the universe of universes as the supreme being, begins to be an author of more completely unanticipated doings. And that's very relevant to the midwares, like I've been saying, because they're
and the 24 different types that are currently known.
Right, I mean, they're such a creature of of the supreme, the fact of the supreme, as opposed to something that is a downstepped expression from the existential. Right, they're a manifestation of experiential deity within. And so even more so relative to them, you don't want to be absolute and say, well, that's never, nothing is ever going to affect that. Nothing's going to alter that. Let's get serious here. There was a time at the beginning of the finite age when the eternal universe, Havona, was altered. Right? If Havona can be completely changed, all bets are off. I mean, what could you say? Well, that's never going to change in the in super universe number three or whatever. Everything could change.
Nobody's using it. <number.
laughs> Right. You know, to be very humble about the possibilities, especially in the distant future. All right.
The members of the older or primary order are generally known by numerals. They are often given names such as 1, 2, 3, the first, 4, 5, 6, the first, and so on. On Urantia, the Adamic midwares are designated alphabetically in order to distinguish them from the numerical designation of the primary midwares.
Okay, so again, we see that, you know, why a triplet? See, again, it's the triunity. You're reminding you again that these, as we were just saying, these are creatures of the triunity within the evolutionary domain. So you indicate that, you know. We'll see in a little bit. Sometimes they have a less numerical, okay, quote unquote name, but usually they're treated in very kind of numerical fashion, as they're saying here, you know, not unlike the secondaries, because again, they're just this mathematical expression of the cosmos, as we've seen. Right, every 70 days you could make one. It's just like it's just a complete mathematical thing playing out, and so they indicate that that they're very much, their origin is part of the machinery of the cosmos, grinding out.
You think they'd say, "I'm not a number."
Remember, you know, right now you're just a number two, right? Until you fuse with your adjuster, you know, you're just a number. You're an unfertilized egg with a number stamped on it. All right, we need to be humble about this. So again, we see the threefold. You know, and so you have 1, 2, 3, the thousandth, right? And from the first all the way up to the thousandth, and 4, 5, 6, to, and then you'd have 148, 149, 150, the first, 148, 149, 150, the thousandth, et cetera, right? All right, so that's the way the primaries are done. And of course, we... Long ago, we ran into 1, 2, 3, the first. What's he up to these days?
He's in the core.
He's a part of the 420 counselors. Yeah, they'll get to that. They'll get to 1, 2, 3, the first as part of the 420 a little later on. All right, keep going.
Both orders are non-material beings as regards nutrition and energy intake, but they partake of many human traits and are able to enjoy and follow your humor as well as your worship. When attached to mortals, they enter into the spirit of human work, rest, and play. But midwares do not sleep, neither do they possess powers of procreation. In a certain sense, the secondary group are differentiated along the lines of maleness and femaleness, often being spoken of as he or she. They often work together in such pairs.
Okay, so I think I've mentioned that recently too. So with the secondaries, you know, think of them more as like a he-she differential. But with the primaries, it's the positive, negative, angelic sort of differential, you know, the aggressive, retiring differential. We've wondered about this. You know, here it is directly. See, they don't eat. You know, like we do. You have all this mystery of exactly how all these different beings in the universe and the whole hierarchy have energy intakes of various sorts. Obviously, the energy intake for the primaries is going to be similar to the way it works for angels. And so you're left again with the secondaries are kind of even more mysterious. I mean, everything about the secondaries is, you know, very curious, right? It's just such a curious combination of things that in other areas are distinct, I mean, they have both adjutant mind and Marantxa mind, and you know, all this. It's a fascinating synthesis thing. See, again, that whole power personality synthesis of the Supreme. You can see how things that you don't think can work together are working together in them. They're just innately this coordination phenomenon. Was there a question somewhere?
I just thought a funny idea. They can appreciate their humor.
Yep.
They come from our Adamic group, which is very humorly blessed. I wonder if they have stand-up comedy shows. sessions. Critics of our...
And you notice kind of the little play there. They enter into the spirit of human work, rest, and play. You know, like literally, RRR, you know. not figuratively, but literally. And again, they don't sleep. Like we were saying, I mean, when you think about all those years of rebel midwares, right, 24/7, 365, for millennia after millennia,
no doubt.
Right, they're up to something. We'll eventually get to that issue. You know, we don't know exactly the physics of that, but they have the potential, apparently, to transport out in space at twice the speed of light. On the planet, right? You're not doing that any more than angels are doing that. We've talked about that. There's all the mysteries of how they move about, and there's going to be some difference, I'm sure, between primaries and secondaries in that regard, because the secondaries are more like us, and so how much do they have to, you know, hoof it, and how much more would they want to have craft, you know, to get from point A to point B, you know, whereas maybe the primaries can kind of delocalize and relocalize like the seraphim do, or something, you know. All that stuff is a little bit mysterious. Oh, yeah, you got something?
What does it mean by attached to mortals?
The primary attachment there is the secondary midwares are attached to the destiny reservists. You know, they're assigned to them to work with them. Yeah. So if for some reason they're, you know, given this assignment where they're not just doing things in general, but they're doing things relative to a specific individual over the course of their lifetime, say, right? They kind of get into the spirit of your day-to-day life. Now they're working. Now they're playing. Now, so in other words, they try to strike step with, you know, the rhythm of your life. Work with it as organically as they can.
If they're having fun, we're having fun.
All right.
Midwares are not men, neither are they angels, but secondary midwares are, in nature, nearer man than angel. They are, in a way, of your races, and are, therefore, very understanding and sympathetic in their contact with human beings. They are invaluable to the seraphim in their work for and with the various races of mankind, and both orders are indispensable to the seraphim who serve as personal guardians to mortals.
You know, when they say a lot of this stuff, you know, you're left, well, give me some specifics. What do you mean exactly? You know, especially when you toss out a word like indispensable and then don't explain it all. And again, you're left to just wonder, because they obviously can't tell us the details. Not allowed to tell us the details. They get as close to the boundaries of the revelatory, you know, limitations as they can. They hint as much as they can. You can attempt to speculate and fill in the blanks. And the thing that I'll just remind you, remember, there's just this handful of secondary midwares. So they're, you basically have almost a one-to-one correspondence in numbers with the number of reservists, you know, destiny reservists. So, you know, if you think about yourself and you know, some sort of a engagement like you might imagine the secondary midwayer having with your life, it's not going to be a secondary midwayer. It's going to be that unrevealed order of angels. Right? For the run-of-the-mill human, right, the beings that have this kind of possible interaction with your day-to-day life, you know, it's not seraphim, it's not cherubim, it's not primary midwayers, it's not secondary midwayers, it's that unrevealed order of angels. That's their job. That's why they hint, you know, they have such a close engagement to you that, you know, saying anything about them would be akin to a betrayal of trust, right? That's the, you know, that's always between the lines. Yep.
Are these unrevealed orders mentioned in the seraphim papers in the local section or the planetary?
No, I mean, you know, you've remember the last time we saw them being mentioned was post-planetary rebellion when Van, you know, and others are kind of taking various roles, and they mention there's the leader of that order of angels, and then they're also mentioned. I was just referring to it, you know, search for akin to a betrayal of trust, you know, right? You can go, right? Go to the Father's worlds, and you know, and you know, see them, you know, referring to them there. But you know, so they just mention them in passing a couple times, because they obviously have, as you like, I'm saying here, there's a lot of interaction between those angels and the doings on this planet, and they're not allowed, you know, to talk about that. And you can speculate about why, you know. You know, you could imagine it's like, well, if they told you about all this stuff, would you have a tendency to go, well, you know, I don't have to do anything, you know, the lesser order of angels will take care of it. I'll just lay here and open my mouth and wait for the dates to fall in my mouth, and you know, right? I mean, you wonder if that's part of it, you know, if it would de-incentivize us or if it would lead to endless, you know, attempts to try to get them to help you, you know, and so you get fixate on it and become this OCD thing, or, you know, I don't know. But anyway, yeah.
And the lower order of angels,
mm-hmm.
I think I heard in the past that it's not one-on-one, but you have one angel for a lot of people.
Well, we don't know anything about how they work. I mean, it's with the guardian angels. It's just with the seraphim, you know, those seraphim that are serving as guardian angels, they're, you know, a pair is engaging 1,000 or a pair is engaging 500. We don't know anything about the logistics of this lesser order of angels. They don't tell us anything about them. See, most of the time, they'll have statements in the book that, you know, if you just take it at face value and knowing that there's that other order of angels, you go, well, this is not a correct statement in the book. But again, you know, it's correct in the limits of what they can say. I mean, you know, they'll say that there is only cherubim and seraphim. Or something. It's like, well, technically there's another one. But, right, you know, so we just don't know anything about the details. The only thing I can say is when they talk about secondary midwayers doing things, and you're going, well, wait a minute, the secondary midwayers are all basically working with the reservists. This sounds to be a more general. Take the order of angels that can do this stuff like secondary midwayers and put them in that role. You know, right? See their statements about secondary midwayers as an indirect way of referring to what that lower order of angels might be up to. Yeah. All right, let's see if we can get a little bit more here.
The United Midwayers of Urantia are organized for service with the planetary seraphim in accordance with innate endowments and acquired skills in the following groups. 1. Midway Messengers. This group bear names. They are a small corps and are of great assistance on an evolutionary world in the service of quick and reliable personal communication.
So instead of saying, you know, send, you know, some mouthful of a designation, they can say send Bob, right, on a messenger mission. So, okay, so.
Send ABC.
Instead of saying, you know, send 1, 2, 3, the, you know, 458, right, I mean, whatever. Right, so she's, that's why they had that qualifier up there about, how did they say that, generally known by numerals. He says, "What? You know, why it was fudgy up there?" See. All right. So you've got a small group that actually have this. They're working a little bit more as individuals and less like cogs in a vast, you know, machine. Bear names like they're saying here. You know, you notice the quick and reliable personal communication. So the quick part, that's, again, what we're just wondering about exactly what's the, how do they get about? And then, you know, notice also in the little preface there, innate endowments and acquired skills, you know, so you have both ability and skill, right? I mean, they aren't all the same flavor. And you were referring, you know, back there, right, in that, you know, when that, in that previous section about the midwares, you know, and they talk about how the secondary, they're divided into 4 physical types, 7 orders spiritually, and 12 levels of intellectual response to the joint ministry of the last 2 adjutant spirits and the Barancha mind, you know, et cetera. There's all this kind of innate diversity. Plus, obviously, they're experiential beings, and they have different, experiences, just by the happenstance of life, if you will. Plus, they could dedicate themselves to some specialization and, you know, become skillful in a certain area, just like we can. So, there's specialization, both innately and and learned. Okay. But, you know, back to the groups. There's some of them that are just doing the messenger thing. What else do we have here?
Number 2, planetary sentinels. Midwares are the guardians, the sentinels of the worlds of space. They perform the important duties of observers for all the numerous phenomena and types of communication which are of import to the supernatural beings of the realm. They patrol the invisible spirit realm of the planet.
Remember how we've talked about that before, that whole intelligence sort of core aspect of them. And that the primaries are always up to that on worlds. They're eyes and ears all over the planet, as it were. And obviously that they... because they're midwayers, they don't have tunnel vision in this regard. I mean, they can monitor all the material doings, all the spiritual doings, you know, all the spirit beings on the planet. I mean, they're very handy in that regard. And the things that the secondaries might not be aware of because they're too high, the primaries, you know, will be aware of because. Things that the secondaries, you know, aren't aware of, you know, because it's at a higher level, because they're at a lower level. See, the primaries would be aware of those, you know, more spiritual, if you will, things that happen kind of above the eyesight of the secondaries. But remember, just a little, you know, aside, both the primaries and the secondaries are too lowly to have any engagement with the archangels and their circuit and all that stuff, right? And that's why the archangel circuit couldn't be used. That's no matter how high they jump, if you were, they can't get up to the right to the the mechanisms of the archangel circuit. It's all above their, you know, their level of nature. Okay, what else do we have here?
Number 3, contact personalities. in the contacts made with the mortal beings of the material worlds, such as with the subject through whom these communications were transmitted, the midway creatures are always employed. They are an essential factor in such liaisons of the spiritual and the material levels.
Okay, and that's, as we've already said, that the secondary midwayers are the ones that are specifically involved there. So in these specialization things, I mean, the immediate thing that is going to differentiate what jobs some of them have is these jobs only a secondary midwayer can do, or these jobs only a primary midwayer can do. So, you know, some of it is just, you know, they have categories just simply because of that, and not due to, different types within, you know, the secondaries, say.
I'm curious about this, you know, subject through whom these communications were transmitted. It doesn't say through whom some of these communications were transmitted. Obviously, contact personnel in this situation, what they're talking about.
Right. And again, like we've talked about, the first thing to remind yourself is you didn't need a contact personality for part four. The midwayers wrote that.
Right.
You know, and so then, on the one extreme, right, you have just the midwayers directly writing some papers, right? And then on the other extreme, you've got this very high being that can't walk up to a secondary midwayer and dictate a paper to him because the secondary midwayer can hold the pencil or pen and write something, right? So you need some way of bridging the vertical divide. You know, for those beings, you needed the contact personality, and you need this whole sophisticated mechanism of the self-acting adjuster bringing in the stuff from, say, the divine counselor, putting it in the mind, and the secondary midwayer pulling it out of the mind, you know, into his mind and writing it down. Right, so you needed that intermediary mechanism to bridge the gulf. Like I was just saying, I mean, normally the communication network has that downstepping mechanism in. You know, a divine counselor can feed something into the communication grid, right, and it gets downstepped, right, so that a secondary mirror can walk up and hear it. But there was no, you know, and they couldn't use the archangel one because it's above them. So they have to have some way to bridge the vertical divide.
On this planet, you mean?
To get these papers. All the papers that are written by Melchizedek, no problem. You know, the Melchizedek can just walk up to the secondary midwayer and dictate it. He can talk to the secondary midwayer. But a divine counselor can't walk up. An archangel can't walk up. Right? Those higher spirit beings have to...
Solitary messenger.
Right, right. Those higher beings, there needs to be some mechanism so you to bridge that vertical divide. So, okay, and then the last little one here.
Number four, progress helpers. These are the more spiritual of the midway creatures, and they are distributed as assistants to the various orders of seraphim who function in special groups on the planet.
In other words, the primaries. So you can see with the three and four, secondaries, primaries, respectively, right, the more spiritual of the midway creatures are the primaries. And, they're working with the various orders of the seraphim because they're very much angel-like. Right? So, that's a little reminder there. You know, I've mentioned that before. It's very, because we're so self-focused, it's very easy to forget that there's a lot more angels on this planet besides guardian angels.
And,
just 8%. All kinds of angels are working on this planet, right, that aren't immediately engaged with, you know, mortals like guardian angels are, you know, let alone guardians of destiny. That's the various orders of seraphim. There's all this stuff. Again, don't just think of master seraphim, right? You know, that's just a small group, relatively. Just general seraphim, all kinds of different flavors, doing all sorts of different stuff, and a lot of it is not talked about that much. The degree to which you, the doings of all those seraphim needs some, some modicum of downstepping interfacing. A primary midwayer can do that, and you're just left to wonder. It's like, well, what exactly are they doing? What needs to be downstepped? The physics of all this stuff, see, is just so mysterious. Yeah, I mean, there's all this spirit energy stuff going on this planet that there's beings engaged with. I mean, we have no idea what all that's about. So, not to mention not only seraphim, but you have all those spirit controller beings. There's progress helpers. Before you think about helping an individual to progress and he redounds to the civilization, I mean, think of them working on progressing the environment in which all immortals exist, progressing the spiritual environment, right? And we all benefit from that. That's the kind of stuff like I'm talking about. That, instead of just thinking in this kind of father-like fashion about, this seraphim as an individual engages this individual for some end, instead of thinking in part-wise fashion, think about the context, that we're all enwombed in, right? And all of the individuals that are tending to that, okay? There's lots of seraphim, daughters of that mother, right, that are tending to the womb, as it were, right? And not so much the parts, like guardian angels are. Okay, we'll stop it right there and get the rest of this section next time. There's a few more fun little tidbits about the basics of the relationship of the midwayers to human affairs that they give us, along the lines of stuff we've been tantalized by here already. So we'll get the rest of that next time. Any other issues that you just can't wait till next week? All right, let's take a moment, everyone.